Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast. They say time flies when you're having fun, and today that's certainly true for us because we're celebrating a significant milestone, which is our 40th episode. Whether you have been following us since we launched this corporate project in 2019 or as a rather new listener who has recently joined us, this milestone is also truly celebrating you. As we're proud to have accompanied you during commutes, long walks and quiet evenings, reaching meanwhile thousands of listeners along the way. And as you might imagine, producing a great show requires dedication. And succeeding in this medium demands persistence, creativity, but also care. And my podcast team, that includes Nina, Joya, Jan-Philipp, and myself, really strive to reflect these qualities in the voices, the stories, and the conversations that we're bringing to you. So really a heartfelt thank you for your trust and loyalty. And we're deeply grateful for your support and really are thrilled about what's coming next. And for today's anniversary episode, we have chosen a topic that should really resonate with almost everybody and has a significant impact on the healthcare as a whole, talking about reproductive medicine and fertility. And that said, I really look forward to exploring this area together with Dr. Corinna Mann. Corinna herself is a recognized specialist in gynecology and obstetrics with additional qualifications in gynecological endocrinology and reproductive medicine, who brings over a decade of experience. She completed her medical training at the Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich, as well as the Harvard Medical School in Boston in 2007. Afterwards, she began her career as an assistant physician at the LMU here in Munich, specializing in gynecology and obstetrics with a focus on gynecological endocrinology and fertility. And following her initial experience, she served for 3 years as a senior physician at the Goldenes Kreuz Fertility Clinic in Vienna, Austria. In 2017, she actually decided to return back to Germany and took a position as a senior physician and deputy manager of the Hormone and Fertility Center at the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, again at the LMU in Munich. Driven by her passion for providing patients really with exceptional care in a more intimate, personalized setting, Corinna established her private practice, which is called the Kinderwunschärztin, which more or less translates into the fertility doctor, at the end of 2019. So taking all this into consideration from my introduction, Corinna is really a distinguished expert in her field, and I'm truly grateful to have you on the podcast today. So again, very warm welcome, Corinna.
Thank you, Thomas. I'm very glad to be here and having this podcast with you.
And today we're actually recording this episode from our Munich office, which is conveniently located near your practice back in the city center and the heart of Munich. And I mean, your CV really reflects an impressive career trajectory. And after completing your education, you initially specialized in gynecology and obstetrics, followed then by an additional subspecialty in gynecological endocrinology and reproductive medicine. That said, what actually inspired you to focus your career on the more hormonal aspects of women's health and fertility? And kind of what are the influencing experiences that you made towards this?
Yeah, so thank you, first of all, for the introduction. And so, yeah, I started my career in obstetrics and gynecology because I just loved doing everything for poor women, doing like the prenatal care, the oncology, doing surgery. And it's a very, very broad field. And we had a wonderful team at the university hospital. So this inspired me to continue my career there. And then very early, I thought I want to like really go deeper into the kind of internal medicine field of gynecology and obstetrics, because hormonal health is kind of like a detective work, because you have a patient that has problems, you look at the patient, you think, what can be the cause, how can I treat it? So it's, I really like the work.
Okay.
And this is part of the gynecological endocrinology and reproductive medicine. So the kind of bigger field is really the reproductive medicine, the fertility treatment. And I was very fascinated because it covers so many aspects. You have the medical field, you have the patients, you have like the psychology behind it, the ethic aspect, socioeconomic aspects, so many aspects that go into this field. And that really fascinated me about this work. We have healthy patients, which is special in medicine, of course, to really have healthy patients. And they're really dedicated for their desire to have children. So they really, really want to do their treatment. They, if we talk to them, they always want to do more than we can offer them. And so they really follow our guidelines. And then other fields during my training, I did the experience, for example, in internal medicine, people who are obese, who have diabetes, you really have to remind them to take their medication. They sometimes they don't see the reason or they don't want to take their medication. And in reproductive medicine, they really care and they take more than they maybe should because the desire is so deep really to fulfill their dreams to get it. Children. So
there seems to be obviously a very intrinsic and high motivation in people, right? And you mentioned a very important point. I mean, they're not having a problem. They are individuals. They're humans, right? They're not patients, really, but they're seeking help for getting reproduced. Yeah? And probably let me ask that question also a bit towards that direction, because you have obviously held successful positions at big university hospitals, fertility clinics, but then you switched into your own private practice. Why did you do this as a question? And also, I know what's very important to you is to have a more personalized, a more intimate relationship to those individuals. Probably you can explore a bit why you did it and how it how it's playing out.
Yes, when I started off my career, I really liked being at the university hospital because it's very challenging. You see a lot of patients, you see the most difficult patients, you have many, many doctors, many senior doctors around you, and you just learn a lot and see a lot. And this is excellent at the beginning. But once you're up to a good expertise and you know a lot of things, for me, it was very important to give like really good and personal care. And I think this is in fertility medicine, very different to other fields of medicine. So if you, for example, have cardiology or neurology, you want to be at the big hospital having like all the specialties. But for fertility medicine, the personalized care is very important because these are usually young women, young couple, they have their work, they have their life, so they're busy. So you really have to focus also how can they manage their appointments, how to approach care. I think it's very important for the patients to have one doctor to care for them. Mm-hmm. And like in big hospital settings, it's sometimes a doctor's off duty. It's rotating. Yeah. One is on vacation and many important aspects might be missed about this patient. And the patient might need to repeat the story over and over, which is kind of challenging for the patient. So I think the personalized aspect, I think, is very important and make the care more comfortable. So this is why we established a private practice. We have a nice setting because it's for the patients very challenging, like in many aspects, time-wise, but also, then a really special situation because for them it's like emotionally very difficult not being able to have children. And so it's very important to take care of them, to give them a good setting. And so, we just have a nice setting of our office. We have nice nurses that take care of the patients. They can reach us by phone. So just like the general setting is very good. And then once they come to us, they have one doctor. So like we really know about their care, know like how to treat them. And the other aspect is, of course, the individualized treatment because it's not the same treatment for all. I mean, this is how medicine is developing anyway in many fields. So like early on, 10, 20 years ago, the treatment was the same for everyone.
For masses only,
people come in with one problem, you get the same treatment. But it's just very different because every individual is different. I mean, the person is different, the hormones are different, the age is different, the egg cell reserve. So everything is very different about each individual patient. So the treatment itself, not only the care, the personal and empathetic care, but the really medical care needs to be different and individualized. And I think this is why the care in the end and the success rates are better is you really take care of the individual patient.
I like the aspect of kind of the surrounding, that intimate setting that you're establishing, because they're in a very special, and we'll come to that later, in a stigmatized situation, I assume. Probably with your husband also joining you as the managing director of the clinic. I would say your work has really truly become also an own family affair, right? And as a mother of four, you also have a profound personal connection to the joys of parenthood, but also the challenges, of course. How has your family life, but also the working alongside your husband, enriched your professional journey? And what's the way you connect with patients through this, probably also?
Yeah, I think this has many different aspects that you're asking.
It does.
So like, first of all, like we started the clinic first was a practice really on the green field because after coming out of the university hospital, I was on maternity leave with my fourth child and I just thought, I don't really want to go back to this big university hospital setting. I want to do something different for my patients. And so then we started really thinking about how we could set this up, like a kind of a startup. So my husband was back then, he was the CEO of a big startup hub here in Germany. So he was into like founding. So we set this business up. So we learned a lot at the beginning, how we have to really set up to all the legal aspects, the medical aspects, and to build up the practice. And then, of course, with our four children, that's a special situation, like balancing work and life and everything at the same time. And I think for us, it works really, really well because now we are very flexible. So taking care of the family, taking care of the fertility practice, and it really grew a lot over the last year. So we started off, like 5 years ago with three people, very basic, very small. And now we have like 30 people. It's really a clinic with an IVF lab, with a, many floors. We have like four floors for the treatment of the patient. We have five doctors. So it really grew. And so, of course, we grew as well with it and developed it. And we cover the aspects. So I'm the doctor. I care, of course, for the patients, for the medical aspects, for the scientific evaluations and the people. And my husband does like the legal work, the economic aspects, because it's, of course, it's a doctor's office, but still a company which needs to take care of all the aspects that a company has.
How many days are you then in the clinic a week? Is it every day on work days, or how demanding is it?
It is demanding. I think I never worked that much, even like without kids prior or in the university hospital, because it's our like practice. So we put a lot of work in it. I work 4 days a week in the clinic. So we start off at like 6:30 or 7, really starting early. So the patients, because they have to come multiple times a week sometimes, and it's demanding. So we start out early in the day. My husband takes care of the kids in the morning, so I can leave early, and he usually works late at night and does a lot of kind of back office work. And so it works really well for us. Yeah.
So there is a lot to do, and this is also reflected in the need for it, right? Because according to the WHO report from 23, around 17.5% of the adult population, which translates in roughly 1 in 6 worldwide, do experience infertility and leaving them with a desire to have a child initially unfulfilled. So running a successful fertility clinic requires, obviously, as you also outlined it, medical expertise, but also empathetic patient interaction that you have with the individuals, and not only the patient itself, but also the husband or the other side of the couple. How you care for them. And particularly as some patients find themselves, as you describe, in a very emotional state of emergency. So how do you foster a supportive and nurturing environment for your patients? I mean, you build the clinic, it's very comfortable there, but how do you kind of break the ice with individual couples seeking your help? And obviously, they have a lot of hope coming to you, meeting you. How do you approach them?
So first of all, really, it's a big issue. One out of six women and men,
it's
are
immense,
it's really immense. And like from my experience, I think it's even more like looking like, and with our friends and everyone, there are many, many people who are affected. And I think it's very important for everyone to know these numbers, because oftentimes, or like 10, 15 years ago, when social media was not as far as today, people always thought, oh, it's just me. Everyone just gets children very easily. It's just me. And people felt and still feel very ashamed to address this topic, because it's they don't want to tell everyone. It's very intimate. So I think it's very good to publish these numbers, and everyone's aware that's not my problem. It's like
one in six.
It's very, very common. You're right. So, and it's like a very intimate wish to get children, because it's an ancient wish for everyone, basically, to reproduce, to have children. And if that doesn't work, it's very, very difficult to accept. And so, first of all, it's a big hurdle that people actually seek the help in the fertility clinic. There are some very good studies in Germany that show that only like a third of the patients really seek help. So there are probably many more patients or people who don't even talk about it and who don't seek help. And this was very important for us, like setting up the clinic, to have the barriers very low. That it's not like, oh, this is the big clinic. I'm very afraid even to make an appointment, go there. But so we try to have it very easy for the patients. They can do like a fertility test very anonymously. They can send us some blood. They can give us a sperm sample. So we can just give them a first impression of their fertility. So have the barriers low. I think this is very important. Have a very inviting atmosphere. So people come in, and some people are very nervous when they come in. They're, yeah, because it's an important appointment for them. They're not sure what to expect. And of course, when we do the first diagnostic treatments or diagnostics, if we do like the hormone checks, it's always very, the people are afraid. What are the outcomes? Will it show maybe I cannot get children at all? So they are very, emotionally.
And that in itself, I'm sure, is also a problem, right? Because if you're in a stress situation, I mean, this has an impact on our body, we know, right? So different hormones are fired out of the body.
It
doesn't make it easier, at least. Yeah.
No, so because you asked, so we try really to make the people comfortable, to make it easy, have a friendly atmosphere. And then we have, when the people first come in to see us, we have 1 hour really for our first consultation. And one hour is really a good amount of time to get an impression. And we go through all the history of the patient. So not only the medical history, but also like what's their social life, what's their lifestyle, because a lot of things of the lifestyle can impact fertility as well. So this is how we invite the patients. We are there for the patients, so we answer like the phone calls very immediately. We're like, of course, secure, but like email contact, so we want to be really reachable for the patients. And I think that makes it easier. And then what's also important, to let the patient know about their history. So what's really going on, what are the treatment options. So we take a lot of time to explain the issue, and then explain the treatment, so the people can really choose what's best for them. Because of course, we as doctors, we pretty much in 10 minutes we could decide, I think that's the right treatment and let's do it. But that's not often the right treatment for this special couple, because the couple might have a different idea. Maybe one wants more children than the other one. Maybe one is undecided. Maybe they have problems in their job. So every situation is different. Some people want a more natural approach. Others just want the highest
just
success rate. Just get it done. So this is very, very individual. And that's, I think, very important to respect that, and just to see where everyone is and what everyone likes as a treatment.
And probably we'll come to that in a second, also what the different treatment options are. But as we talk also numbers, if there is only one third coming to seek help, give or take, is there also numbers in how many cases a fertility clinic like yours or also others can be of help and can make that wish come true? Because we are also obviously seeing a lot of advancement in medicine. Equipment is getting cleaner, science is getting more advanced, and you know, right? What's kind of the success rate, so to say?
It's a very good question, and there are many, many numbers. So I think we have worldwide, and especially in Germany, a very good system to collect our numbers. It's pretty unique for medicine. So all the reproductive centers, we send in our data to one set where we collect all the data, and there's we have very good rates of success, and it's really age related. So I think this is a very, very important topic for everyone to know, that's really age related, because the fertility is at its highest in the late 20s until like 32. And if you ask for numbers, so our, what we do, like the maximum treatment is the IVF and ICSI treatment. We'll talk about that later. And so the success rate are about like 40-45% per cycle with, let's say, 32. But with 40, it drops down to about 20-22. And with 44, it's just 5%. And then you have the miscarriage rate. So not every pregnancy, of course, leads to a healthy baby. But unfortunately, there's some miscarriage in the way. And if people get older, the miscarriage risk is a lot higher. So these numbers are very important. The set, so this is the number for one cycle. And it's important to keep up the treatment, because unfortunately, in reproductive medicine or fertility treatment, we don't do one treatment and that's it. But it's usually like a journey. Of course, you first have to do diagnostics, you have different approaches, there are failed cycles, and this is very emotional for patient and very difficult, because they have a lot of ups and a lot of downs, unfortunately. If you do a lot of treatments and then you get a negative test, it's very devastating. And so it's very important that people stick with the treatment and not only do one cycle, but do two, three, maybe four. But of course, this is a long way. This is a lot of time, a lot of money also, a lot of treatment burden. But if people really stick with the treatment, and I think that's part of what we do, because we say we make it as comfortable as possible, so people stick with it and don't leave after one cycle because they said, oh, this was too much. I cannot handle it anymore. So if people really stick with it, they have a success rate of 90%. It's really a lot. Not everyone. Yeah? Okay. And it depends, of course, on the age. Like if a woman is 43, it's a lot more difficult to help her than if she's 32, for example.
Sure. And as we have been talking around kind of a range of treatment options that you also offer in your private practice, you will obviously determine the best suitable approach for the individual, as you mentioned before. Recommending classic in vitro fertilization that most of us know, I assume, or also intracytoplasmic sperm injection. Probably you can also explain that in a second. You only recommend that, I assume, when other traditional or less invasive methods are unlikely to succeed. So what is it in the first place, and what are the criteria that you use to decide whether you pursue more a classical, more a non-invasive versus a more modern, probably more invasive approach in the end?
First, we run diagnostics, of course, to know what's going on with the patient. Then the easiest option to do is like a cycle monitoring. So to tell the patient when is the most fertile window, when it's best to have intercourse. So that's very easy for us. We just monitor the cycle. We determine the best time point of intercourse. The next treatment option is the hormonal treatment. So we can give hormones to improve the egg cell growth. If people have hormone problems, if the egg cells are not growing, so to help them that the egg cells actually ovulating, which can lead to a pregnancy. Or if people are older, this helps to have more egg cells to just have a higher chance of getting pregnant. Then the next step is called IUI, which means that we get the sperms of the partner. We prepare the sperms, we wash the sperms, we get out the best sperms, and we put it with a small catheter into the uterus. This is still, it's an assisting procedure, but it's still fairly easy. There's no risk involved. And the next step is the IVF or ICSI treatment, which means we stimulate the egg cells of the woman. So we give them hormones over a period about 10 days. These are injections always. They have to inject the medication every day at the same time. They have to come see us around 3 or 4 times for an ultrasound and blood checkup until we know the egg cells are mature. We can pick them up. So then we do a little, it's called like an egg retrieval. It's a surgery where we have a fine needle and where we take out the egg cells out of the follicles of the woman in the surgery room. Then we give the egg cells to our IVF laboratory. They collect the sperms from the partners and they bring the sperms and the egg cells together. And so IVF, this is like the, what you call everything. And IVF means that we have one egg cell and we have many, many sperms and we just put them together basically in the dish. And then the fastest sperms finds the way into the egg cell. This was how it started off. And the ICSI treatment means that we have one sperm, we really select, or the our lab technicians and the biologists do that. They select a sperm under the microscope, the sperm which is most most fertile, moves perfectly, has a good appearance. And then we put this sperm into the egg cell. And this means ICSI treatment. We do this treatment when the partner, the male part is infertile, if the sperm count is very low, if the sperms are not good, or if an IVF doesn't work, then we do the ICSI treatment. So the patient is the same thing, but just the procedure in the lab is different. Then we have the, on the next day, we can check, are the egg cells fertilized? The embryos develop in a in the lab, so we can watch them for 5 days until they develop into an embryo. We call it a blastocyst, and then we can transfer the embryo into the uterus. So this is a very complex treatment, very, I mean, it's a routine for us, but it's, of course, it's very advanced, very challenging in the lab as well. We have a clean room for this. So the lab technicians are working in the clean room, having the embryo develop, and this developed over the last 30 years, really. It's an advancing field. What's important for us that we look at the patients, talk to the patients, see really what's the reason that they don't get pregnant. So we check what's the problem. And then we talk to the patient, what's the right approach for them. And also depending on the age, because if a woman is 30, we have more time. We can take it easy. We go step by step. If a woman is 40, we say, okay, let's take a fast track maybe.
More invasive than from the get-go. No, absolutely. And I mean, since the birth of the very first IVF baby back in 1978, approximately 3.5 million children have been born worldwide through assisted reproductive technologies. Obviously, the financial burden of IVF can be substantial, as you mentioned before, often requiring multiple cycles and also additional costs for medications, consultations, and the like. And in the US, a single cycle can cost up to 30,000 dollar, while costs vary obviously across European countries. So in some regions, infertility treatments may also not be fully covered by insurances, leading to disparities in accessibility based on, well, socioeconomic influencing factors in the end. So your clinic per se treats all patients regardless of their insurance state. Yet patients with statutory health insurances must pay out of pocket. So how do you guide your patients through the financial complexities next to their emotional complexities and medical complexities that they're having during their treatment journey?
It's a very important question because, of course, money is important for the patient and the affordability. So the prices are very interesting because, like you mentioned, in the US, it's so much more expensive. It's really $30,000. It's a lot, really. It's so difficult for patients to afford this. In Germany, for example, it's still expensive, but a lot less. So depending on the treatment, it's per cycle between 3,000 to 5 or 6,000 euros per cycle if you do like the most advanced treatment with with ICSI treatment, which is a lot of money, but a lot cheaper than in the US.
Sure.
So actually, there's a lot of tourism that people travel from the US to European countries, mostly to Spain, to Czech Republic, to Greece, because it's the treatment is a lot cheaper. And they are, we'll talk about that later. It's very, they are allowed to do other treatments than we're allowed to do in Germany. So the costs in Germany, it's if you're insured by the public system, the costs are covered for people who are under 40, who are married, and over 25. and so this actually excludes quite a bit of patients from the public healthcare system anyway. The German system covers three cycles, but only pays the half. So people always have to pay the extra halves by themselves.
And so it's a co-pay system then?
It's a co-pay system. It changed a long time already ago, but of course this puts a lot of financial burden on all patients doing an IVF. And the what's covered by the public insurance is only the very basic treatment, so IVF treatment. But for example, the culture for embryos until day five, which is more or less common practice, is not covered, or freezing embryos is not covered. And these are adds up to quite a bit of financial burden. In our practice, we have a private practice because we said we really want to have time for our patients. We don't want to rush. We don't want to have like an industry pushing like a lot of patients through it, but we want to have time to really approach the patients individually. And this is in our healthcare system really only possible with taking the time, having a private practice. So we are very transparent in the prices because I think that's very important for people to know before they come to the office what do I have to expect. What's interesting, for example, that is very different in every country. So in Israel, it's covered everything. So they can do IVF cycles as many as they want to get up to two children up to the age of 45, which is incredible. With like we said, 44, the chances are so low, but in Israel, they cover all the treatment costs. So, and they are very advanced also in the IVF treatment. So that's interesting. So every country has really its own rules. So we could talk for hours about like the different rules in every, even European countries.
And also fertility and family building benefits are also increasingly employer-sponsored programs that are designed to support employees on their journey towards parenthood. And in the US, these benefits are part of standard packages sometimes offered by many companies. And in Germany, more and more companies also like ours, we are promoting reproductive health, subsidizing in vitro fertilization through corporate health insurance, for instance. So how do you perceive the impact of this trend towards subsidizing from an employer perspective towards the access for fertility treatments, but also as you're working with those couples seeking help and getting support from their employers, how does that probably also redefine an employer's role in people's life?
I think it's very an interesting aspect that's fairly new. In the US, there are many, many companies. I think it's like 50 or 60% of the big companies really cover fertility benefits. Maybe it's also because the costs, of course, are a lot more than they are in Germany. I mean, the whole healthcare system works differently in the US than here. In Germany, there are very, very few companies that cover the or offer fertility benefits. It's usually the American companies who have offices here. I think it's a very interesting aspect because as a big company, you can really take over the healthcare for your employees, and fertility is such a big and important issue. I think there's something completely different than covering dental costs or giving someone, for example, like as a benefit, a car or whatever. This is gone and children stay, or if you have, for example, if you do social freezing, you really, I think as an employer, you give your employees the impression, I really care for you, I care for your family, I care for your life. So I think it's a very good option for companies to do that.
So we need to talk again, I guess, numbers, because mm-hmm. recent research indicates that the global fertility rates have been declining for the last decades, reaching also historically low levels. And although the global population may surpass still 10 billion by 2050, the growth momentum is slowing. And over the next 25 years, regions like East Asia, also Europe, Russia, are projected to experience a significant population decline, potentially affecting, obviously, as we can read in media all the time, economic progress, long-term social structures, including pension systems, healthcare systems, housing, education, and so on and so forth. In your opinion, what measures should be taken to address these demographic trends and encourage fertility at the one angle? Yeah, because we want to have, obviously, a fertile population and we want to grow. We want to have all those benefits. At the same time, 10 billion is quite something. And this will challenge us for how do we keep food, water, energy supply and the like sustainable. So what's your perspective on this and how do we kind of balance this?
Yeah, that's a very interesting, good question. I think these are really two aspects, because the one aspect is the overpopulation, having, like you said, 8, 9, 10 billion people really in the world. So this is a lot.
Yes.
And in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, I think the fertility rate is like 4.5 per woman, which is a lot. And the reason is not because the women really want to get that many children, but they don't have any contraceptive. They are not well educated. So they have no other options. So I think in this aspect for these countries, it would be very important to do a good health education, giving accessibility for a contraceptive and giving the woman the opportunity to have a family what they wish and not
give
like as many children.
Yeah,
yeah give yeah. them a choice. So I think this is a very important aspect. Also, of course, the infertility aspect is in Africa as well. It's not that a lot of women don't get children, and for them it's a lot more difficult than in our society if they're not fertile.
Can imagine.
These are many different aspects. Of course, I think for our societies, like for the Western societies, the fertility rate is really, really low, which is terrible, I think. Mm-hmm. Right? In Germany, it's like 1.35, which is too little. We need 2.1, of course, to keep our population stable. And in South Korea, which is a very developed country, they're like 0.7 because the people don't feel confident anymore. They don't want to have children anymore. It's for them not manageable to work and have children. So I think society really has to change here, because this is dramatic, and it won't be dramatic in 200 years, but it will be dramatic in like 20 or 30 years already. So I think we really have to take some measures. For our society here, of course, there are many things to do, but I think the most important aspect is to have a better childcare, so it's possible for women to have children and work at the same time. I think that's the biggest issue. And if we like consider the fertility, I think we need to get access to fertility care for everyone who needs it, because there's so many people in Germany who really want to have children, who would educate their children, giving a big impact for society, and they're not able to get children. And I think this would be very important to help them and give them all the help that they need.
I also want to pick on one other element, because you talked about the age, and the age obviously having a very decisive impact on getting kids with help or without help, as we know. There is the terminology and also the trend out of social egg freezing, which is a fertility preservation method for human eggs that are frozen at temperatures of close to minus 200 degrees Celsius to protect against future infertility and also delaying childbearing. And it actually really increased nearly 40% year over year between 22 and 23 only. So it's really kind of rocketing. The method offers obviously flexibility, aligning a broader movement towards delayed parenthood as women navigate careers, relationships, reproductive choices and the like. How do you foresee financial accessibility and insurance coverage evolving to make social egg freezing a viable option for a broader demographic? Yeah. And how do you think changing cultural views will affect how we talk about balancing parenthood with career ambitions and personal life choices, which is very personal, right? So can you explore a bit there, please?
Yeah, of course. So social freezing is a fairly new aspect in reproductive medicine. I mean, the techniques have been around for many years. And I think 2013, the American Society deemed this not as experimental anymore, but as a like common practice. But still, it took quite a long time until society adapted it. So like in many fields, the Americans are a lot quicker to adapt things. And there it has been running for a longer period of time. In Germany, we've been doing it for quite a while, but it really picked up speed, I would say, only like 3 or 4 years ago. And now it's very fairly recent, thanks to social media, I think, because even 4 or 5 years ago, people didn't know about it. Most people didn't know about it. It really, they said, oh, I heard about this. This is surprised. So many people didn't know about it. We had many people coming to our office said, oh, my gynecologist never told me about it. I didn't know this existed. So now really, yeah, thanks to social media and everything, many people know about it, not everyone yet. So, and we in our, since it's a private practice, we're in the heart of Munich. We have a lot of singles, a lot of working women here in Munich. So we have many women coming for social freezing, like every day, many women. So it's, and from the numbers, so in the US, of course, their population is bigger. They have like 40,000 cycles per year now, which grew tremendously. In Germany, we have around like 3,000 to 4,000 cycles, but still you see there's still a way to go. Mm-hmm. And, like my sister is 10 years younger than me and like in her, like everyone is doing the social freezing in her, like all her friends. And so it's fairly, So, and when I hear people like talking around their early 30s, it's fairly common, or at least like in the people who are working a lot, thinking about their career, postponing motherhood. So it's fairly common to do it. And it's of course, a perfect preventive measurement because, age is the most important factor about fertility. Yes. We talked about the numbers earlier. If you want to have a child with 30, your chances are pretty good. And with 45, there are almost no chances left. So and even between the ages of like 35 to 40, the fertility drops within 5 years dramatically. And five years are gone, of course, in a second. Yeah, if you do career, if you develop, if you don't have a partner, for example, just time flies by and the fertility drops. So social freezing is a very good preventive measurement, really, to preserve the fertility.
So it's preventative. It's increasing the success rate, but it's also then lowering the costs. Once you're seeking help and requiring help, it might even bring down costs at that time because you're having kind of better eggs to cope with.
Or? Yes, of course. I mean, social freezing itself does cost a lot of money. So, like you asked, what could be? Yeah. How could you like lower the financial burden? I'm not very optimistic that in Germany the healthcare system will pay for it because preventive medicine still is not really paid for. It's always like people have to get sick and then you treat it and you treat it for lots and lots of money and you treat the illness. But to be preventive, I think we could do in all fields of medicine, we could do a lot better there. Yeah. And so if you freeze your eggs with 30, for example, or 32, and then you do IVF with the egg cells when you're 42, it will be, you're right, cheaper because you will probably you're a lot more successful. It will be a lot quicker. But of course, the treatment costs itself, it's not that cheap. Getting children on your own is cheaper.
No. But obviously, this is the cheapest way, I assume, right? But still, probably you need only, I don't know, 2-3 cycles versus 5-6 cycles, right?
Yeah,
because the quality of the eggs or the sperms or whatever is better.
It's a lot better.
Got it. So diversity in the desire to have children has obviously become increasingly prominent with significant growth in family building among same-sex couples and singles, as you also pointed out, particularly through sperm donation. And a recent study found actually that more than 40% of married same-sex couples under 50 express a very strong desire to have children. So same-sex and transgender couples face distinct fertility challenges and must navigate even more complex reproductive options. So, for example, lesbian couples may select a sperm donor or choose IVF to share genetic and gestational roles, while gay men require both an egg donor and a surrogate, while trans individuals seek family building strategies before, during, and after transition. So it's getting complex. What I'm getting at. So how has your practice adapted to meet the diverse needs of those different people that wish for children. I mean, how do you cope with that? Yeah. Do you see this already in private practice, or is this kind of an academic paper exercise?
Not at all. It's right in the field. So this is what I really love about reproductive medicine, because when I worked in the university hospital, we had basically women and men who want to have children. That's basically it. And now we have a very, very complex approach, and that makes it very inspiring, challenging every day, having like the different settings. For us, it's really routine. We have everyday lesbian couples. We have a single woman we treat every day. So I think, I mean, the numbers I'm not sure about, but I think they're about like 10% of the population is lesbian. Mm-hmm. So there are many people who are, seek health. And for them, of course, it's always clear. They will need a sperm donor to get a child. So it's quite interesting. They come earlier for fertility care. So they're usually people come in their early 30s compared to man-woman couple who maybe come with their late 30s. Mm-hmm. So I think we have a really open-minded culture. We have people know they're very welcome, no difference what their orientation is, what they want. So we have single woman, lesbian couples who we treat with the sperm donors. We explain it to them very well. There's, of course, a lot of aspect. It's not only the medical aspect, but the psychological aspect, the psychosocial aspect, really, to how you put it into society. How do you talk to your friends about it? How do you talk about to your child about it later on, how to put it into the context? There are legal aspects, of course, many legal aspects about it. And since you ask about like all the different situations, so we can only treat female couples in Germany because surrogacy is not allowed in Germany and egg donation is not allowed. So for gay people, for men, we cannot treat them. So they usually go abroad to like the US or to other countries for treatment.
But they still would first come to you, right?
No. They know about this. The legals. Yeah, no. So we really see female couples and we see a lot of single women. So this is really like a, I don't know if you want to call it a trend, but this is something comparably new and really advancing, because a lot of couples divorce, there are a lot of singles, and women say, okay, I'm financially independent, I really want to have a child, I didn't find the right partner, I will try it on my own, they have a very good setup, and think about it. And so it's, for us actually, it's very common.
But from an inclusion perspective, it has its difficulties, right? So we're excluding actively parts of those patients that wish for kids, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. That's our, the legal situation in Germany.
So something that we need to take to Berlin and Munich and wherever it happens. So, I mean, as we know, also nutrition has a big impact on people's life per se, but also reproduction levels. Supplements, micronutrients can aid to conceiving by improving egg quality, sperm health, and the like. So with rising infertility, as we discussed, and also at the same time heightened awareness of options through social media, the global market for those natural fertility supplements is really rocketing. It's in 24, it's 2.3 billion, but 34, it's projected that it's close to 6 billion only for this field. What is your perspective on the role of natural fertility supplements like the folic acid, vitamin D, omega-3 fatty acids and the like? Is it having an impact, and what would you recommend there?
So that's a very good question. So in reality, everyone takes supplements. So every patient asks me about it. So I'm taking this. They usually have a list. So what should I do? I mean, some are only taking the basics, others taking more advanced fertility supplements. So it is a big topic, and everyone is asking about it. And also, of course, generally with the supplements, it's a lot easier to take supplements than changing your lifestyle. So our patients are really healthy. They're very good. They don't smoke. They have a normal weight. But in general, like the whole population, of course, many people smoke, they're overweight, but they prefer to take supplements rather than quitting to smoke. But this would have a much, much bigger impact, for example. But saying that, so for example, with the folic acid, what you mentioned, it's really interesting, because this is known since the 1980s. 80s that it has a relation to birth defects in the children. Mm-hmm. So this is well known for a long time, but it took like 30 years, really a long time, until everyone in society, every doctor and every patient really accepted this as a common practice to take folic acid. So it took mm-hmm. very long. And I think we have to keep this in mind for the other micronutrients and the supplements, because there are only a couple of studies. So there are a few studies that show it really, it helps fertility, it mm-hmm. helps the egg cells, but there are some studies. And I think for like certain situation, it can really be of help. Mm-hmm. But still, we have to be careful about what's the evidence. Mm-hmm. But keeping in mind that some things take so long until to adapt it. And people who are now 38, they don't have time to wait 30 years until everyone says, oh, maybe coenzyme Q10 could help. But mm-hmm. if it doesn't harm, of course, they can take it and keep up their fertility. On the other hand, the market is not regulated at all. Mm-hmm. So this is very, I think, dangerous, because mm-hmm. there it's not regulated like a pharmaceutical product, but everyone basically can sell it. And if you look closer at the products, many of them are not good. So mm-hmm. many of the products are either the vitamins are way too low or way too high, and they've put a claim on it. Oh, we have coenzyme Q10, but it's maybe only a tenth of what would be helpful. And people need to be very educated. So we always talk about with our patients, because they ask about it, and we have a close look. What do they take? Really, what amount should they need? And it's a very unregulated market. Of course, there's a big, big demand, but I think you have to be really careful about which nutrients to take. Mm-hmm. And there are many additional like fillers also in the supplements where you have to be careful about it. So I think this is a complex aspect to really get a good products, good health, but it, yeah, I agree. It's of course big market, but I think it probably should be regulated more.
I mean, talking about regulation, probably, mm-hmm. because we need to talk about it, as we in Germany have a legislation, the Embryo Protection Act, that is dating back to 1990. And the German Medical Association is also advocating for reform and highlighting shifts in societal understanding of self-determination, family, life realities, job realities. Over the past 30 years or so, when coming here, reading into it, it's kind of really eye-opening. Mm-hmm. So rapid advancements mm-hmm. in reproductive mm-hmm. Medicine have raised numerous medical, legal, mm-hmm. ethical, mm-hmm. as we discussed, exclusion of certain parts mm-hmm. of the population that remain people inadequately addressed by current law. Yeah. This creates obviously challenging situations for some patients that may not receive guidance on internationally available treatments in Germany, because we're not updating this law. And for that, facing even further barriers in pursuing their desired outcomes. So additionally, doctors do also risk legal repercussions, mm-hmm. I learned, when discussing these prohibited international alternatives. Yeah. So how do these legal limitations mm-hmm. affect patients seeking treatments? Mm-hmm. And what changes would you propose to better align the German's legal framework with global reproductive practices that are there in reality?
Yeah, like you said, the law is like 35 years old now, and in fertility medicine, everything has changed in the last 35 years. So it's a really, really outdated law. So, and there are many or like different aspects about it, which I think should really be changed. There was mm-hmm. a slight change in 2011 where the pre-implantation diagnostic had been added. So this is testing the embryos before they implant to mm-hmm. give like the couple an idea, is the embryo genetically healthy or not? So this was added 2011. But still in a very complex manner. So in Germany, if I tell this to patients, I always have to think, wow, they must think Germany is really so complicated, because there's an ethics committee. So mm-hmm. the patients have to apply to the ethics committee mm-hmm. with a quite amount of paperwork to apply if they are eligible to do the genetic testing. Mm-hmm. They meet about 4 or 5 times a year, and it usually takes like half a year until they get the patients the approval to do the genetic testing. And since we were talking, timing is crucial. It's a really bad setting, I think, in Germany to have this. So most or many people go abroad for the genetic testing, which is like a pity, because they need to take a lot of travel costs and everything, going to another country and doing all the treatments abroad, which technically, of course, could be done also here. Then there's the big topic of egg donation. This is if people either they're too old or if they have early menopause, which is really an issue for about 1% of all women. They get into early menopause before the age of 40 and they don't know it. And so they don't have any egg cells. And they, if they want to have children, they either need to adopt or they could do the egg donation, which is done in many other countries, like on a very routine basis, for example, in Spain or Czech Republic, or of course the US, they're doing a lot of egg donation, and it's not allowed in Germany. It's really, like you said, forbidden by law. So we are not allowed to tell the patient about this. We cannot tell them, hey, go to this clinic. We cannot tell them anything about success rates. So we really, as doctors, you have to leave the patients alone. And I think that's terrible, especially if you're taking care of patients and they said, no, sorry, there are the options, but I cannot tell you about this. And our treatment stops here. And then they're free floating on the market internationally. They have to refer to website and see what other clinics are abroad offering. So I think this is a terrible situation. And especially like last year, there was a big committee that met for about a year. A lot of doctors, psychologists, lawyers, people who really cared about the ethics. So they met in a big committee. They worked on a paper and they gave it to the federal government last year. But we had another government last year. And they really, so this big committee out of many, many experts, they said, yeah, there's nothing. So we could recommend egg donation, or it could be done in Germany, like from all the legal aspects. So of course, you have to work out all the like the aspects about it, but it could be done. But then it stopped. So which is really a pity, so that we are so restricted in the treatment. And the third thing, which is very important, is the selective embryo transfer, which is important to really get the best embryo for the treatment. For example, if a woman, let's say, has 10 egg cells, 10 egg cells get fertilized. Out of these 10 egg cells, maybe 3 embryos will develop. And so in most other countries, the IVF labs can just let develop the 10 embryos and decide at the end which one is the best and transfer this one embryo. In Germany, we are not allowed to do this. So we can only say, oh, we have to this 3 or 4 that we let develop to transfer this one embryo. And this led to a lot of twin pregnancies because doctors said, oh, then let's transfer 2 just to be on the safer side. But then a lot of twins developed. So we don't do this anymore. We really transfer 1. But the treatment makes it a lot more difficult for patients. And in the end, they have the same outcome, but they need more time to really find the right embryo to transfer. And these are all aspects, I think, that should be changed.
Wow. I mean, what a ride through a very important, highly important field that cannot really be more personalized. And I certainly learned a lot. So thank you very much for sharing your expertise, your experiences from the field on fertility and reproductive medicine. And yeah, for a very energetic and honest conversation that we just had. What I'm particularly taking away for me is first the numbers. So 1 in 6 having a problem, only 1 in 3 actively seeking for help, which is not a lot in the end. The factors preventing this we discussed. The second is that this field is probably one of the most personalized and also preventative fields in medicine, also through social freezing. You can prevent a lot, and also through better nutrition, you can prevent a lot again. And also, still, it's a very vibrant and fast-paced setting. There is an overhaul very needed for the legislation. 35 years, not looking at the law is probably not the right way to go forward the next 35 years. So keeping fingers crossed there. So thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Be sure to check out our other episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or whatever you prefer to listen. Stay tuned for our next episode next month. And until then, take care and stay safe.
Strategy and Strategy made real.